ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Milwaukee has long prided itself on its diversity, with enclaves of ethnic groups settling in the area for generations. But long before the Germans, the Poles, Slovaks, Italians, and Irish arrived, there's been a population of Native Americans here. In fact, today Milwaukee is home to the largest number of Native Americans living in any American city east of the Mississippi. And UW-Milwaukee has made a major commitment to serve the Native American population through its Electa Quinney Institute. Joining us on this edition of UWM Today is the director of the Institute, Margaret Newton, and Nathan Bry, a student who has worked at the Institute. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on today's program, Nathan and Margaret. I think a lot of people are surprised, Margaret, when they learn how large the population of the Native Americans is, both here in the city of Milwaukee and in the state of Wisconsin.
I think they are, but it's something that is ever-present when you look at some of the names. We have the name of our city, the names of our rivers, the names of the lakes near us, Lake Michigan, Lake Winnebago, the Menominee, Kinnickinnick Rivers. These are all words in indigenous languages. So once you think about it, you start seeing that that history is actually all around us still.
And the Institute itself is, when you think about the history of Native Americans here, it's relatively young at the university.
Yeah, the Institute has been around just about 20 years now. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary next year. And it was endowed by an elementary school that will be celebrating its 50th anniversary next year. So we have presence that extends back to, you could look at the Lake Park Mound being 2,000 years old, and we could look at our Institute being relatively new in that context, but it's a good way to have people remember the history of the space.
What do you see as the primary purpose of the Institute?
The Institute was originally founded with the name the Electa Quinney Institute because Electa Quinney was a Stockbridge-Munsee woman who took it upon herself when this area was still a territory and multiple nations were moving around. Some people were relocating here. Other people were relocating their communities in response to settlement. And it was working to become a state. She created a classroom for everybody, for Native students, non-Native students, people of various tribal backgrounds, various immigrant backgrounds. So her goal was education, and the Institute tries to continue her work in a different way, in a different time, but we really focus on education. Sometimes we are working on educating the citizens of these sovereign nations around us, but sometimes we're working to educate the other citizens around us about the sovereign nations and the people in the space.
And the idea is not just to keep the memory of Native American history alive, but to actually still live that culture, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have around 500 Native students, and they use the languages on campus, in their office. I often have people greet me with Minogaje Baoget. I might be walking across the plaza or into the library. And we try to make sure that these communities and cultures are visible and people hear them. People know that it is a part of who we all are in this community, in this part of Wisconsin.
Well, Nathan, you're one of those students. What attracted you to learn more about your Native culture?
Well, it gave me a sense of community. Like, so learning the language and practicing the culture, found that it was more than just me in the city that was still learning the language and practicing the culture. So the Electa Quinney Institute turned into my family, especially being on campus. When I had problems on campus or even in my personal life, it was those people that I turned to for guidance and support. And then I can say that if it wasn't for the Electa Quinney Institute, I wouldn't be pursuing my degree as it was now.
Yeah, and you have a real interesting background because before you were a student, you were out in the work world.
For sure. Yeah, I was a firefighter paramedic for almost 15 years. And then a back injury sent me back to school.
Uh-huh. And did you ever imagine when you were fighting fires and making paramedic runs that you someday would be immersed in the study of your Native American culture?
No, I sure did not. I didn't expect to be in the college setting, let alone succeeding as well as I am college.
Yeah. How about your family members? Are they surprised to see you taking this academic turn in your life?
Yeah. Many of my family members are very surprised. All my background has been in emergency medicine and fighting fires. So when I took up academia and succeeded in it, they were all surprised, especially that I made the dean's list and graduated with honors with my undergraduate degree. A lot of my family gave me a hard time about it, surprised that I did so well.
Hard time in a good sense, correct?
Correct, right? Correct.
Margaret, Nathan's story is just wonderful. Is that typical of the 500-plus students, Native American students on the campus that you're connected with through the Institute?
I think it is. I think it's a real mix that we have on campus. we have students who are coming from highly educated households where they are the children of professors and lawyers and doctors, and they know that this is the right place for them to be able to learn both their academic content and also get indigenous cultural support. And then we have a lot of people who are veterans returning to their community after having worked overseas, who are mothers returning to the workforce after having spent time with kids. So it's a real mix. We have traditional students in every sense of the word, but we also have very non-traditional students. I guess for us in indigenous communities, they all become traditional after hanging out with us a little bit.
Yeah. Well, what about students who might be Polish descent, German, Italians? Is there a place for them to learn about Native American culture through Electa Quinney Institute?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have, I would say every year, it's about 50-50. We have people who say, I have lived in this space for a very long time. I'm from Germantown or Wauwatosa, and I really want to know more about the history of this place because my family has lived here now 4 or 5 generations, and we really feel connected to the space, and we want to know more about it. We also have the students from various nations. So it really is a nice eclectic group. Everybody works on the same languages together, works on the same history, but they come from many different backgrounds.
I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear that there are, what, a dozen tribes here in the state of Wisconsin. It certainly was a surprise to me as I was doing research for today's program.
Yeah, definitely. We have 12 nations that are sovereign nations, and we have a real variety. So the Ho-Chunk experience is very different than the Ojibwe experience, very different than the Oneida, the Menominee. And it is very nice to see the students get together and learn more about each other. I've had many students who come from the heart of the Menominee Nation, and they've never really hung out with some Ho-Chunks. They've also maybe never hung out with some folks who are Hmong or Latino. There are differences that people can learn about each other and really explore their own culture and the broader Milwaukee and Wisconsin community.
Nathan, what nation are you from?
Lekta Flambo, Ojibwe.
Okay. And that's up north, right?
Northern Wisconsin.
Northern Wisconsin.
Yes.
And did your relatives, did your family migrate down to Milwaukee, or does family still live up in that part of the state?
I still have family that lives up in that way. Yeah. Northern Wisconsin, Canada, and also in the Oshkosh area. So I have family scattered throughout Wisconsin and Canada.
So as Margaret described the connections and the relationships that are built up between Native American students who come from different backgrounds, what has that experience been like for you personally?
I've been more open-minded. I enjoy the diversity that we offer at Electa Quinney, and try to bridge the gaps for any misunderstandings that may be taking place. So I think it's a very – Electa Quinney provides a safe space for everyone to kind of bridge the gaps and explore what they don't know about other cultures.
Uh-huh. And so as a non-Native American, I'm Slovak from my grandparents coming over from Eastern Europe. I have to confess, I until we began thinking about the work that Electa Quinney does, until I began thinking about it, I tended to generalize and said, well, you know, Native Americans are all the same, right? Even though they may come from different nations, but clearly that's not the case.
Yeah, definitely. There's very big differences. We have over 560 nations in the United States, and really getting to know some of the variation is something I think a lot of Americans may have missed, because we tend to encounter American history as American and not American. And so that not American and its rich diversity is something I think we all can work on. I see students all the time having vigorous debates about how to handle powwow protocols and how they come together as a group and do things in a way that feels right to people from the Stockbridge-Munsee community, to people from Ojibwe communities, to people who are Menominee, Ho-Chunk. Even with the languages, the Ho-Chunk and Menominee tend to use their language primarily in their own community, whereas the Ojibwe tradition is to use it everywhere. We create websites. We were originally, even hundreds of years ago, moving around the area with traders and with the people who were arriving, telling them, well, this is a big river, Michizibing. That's how the Mississippi got its name. Or these people are people who we connect with wild rice, the Menominee. That's how they got their name. So in many ways, you have very big difference between cultures and how they want to share and how much they want to share. It's a delight to see the students work through all of that and understand their own variation as well.
And what an important lesson for those of us who are not Native American to not generalize and not stereotype because of the variety. It would be like saying, well, if you're from Eastern Europe, Poles and Hungarians and Slovaks or Czechs are all the same. Clearly, a big mistake, and that would be a mistake to make when thinking of the nations that are here in Wisconsin. Nathan, language. How did you, as growing up, speak of the language of your ancestors?
No, growing up, I listened to my uncle speak it. He was fluent in Ojibwe and Ojikri, and I picked up some of the language there. But it wasn't until I started 5 years ago at the Electoquinny at UWM working with Margaret and the Electoquinny Institute that I start picking up and becoming more fluent in the language now.
How difficult was it to learn Ojibwe?
It can be trying at times. You have to be patient with any language, you know. You just need to be patient and have your due diligence on learning the language.
And Margaret, you are quite a linguist. I understand you speak many, many languages. French, right? Latin, Ojibwe. I'm just beginning the list here.
It is a continual process, learning more languages. For me, after having really specialized in Anishinaabemwin, that's the term that we would use as an umbrella term for the language that is shared by the Potawatomi, the Odawa, and the Ojibwe. And then being able to bridge dialects. I'm originally from Minnesota. I taught for a while in Michigan. I work frequently in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario. That language spreads across that entire area, and there are a lot of dialects. So for me, I felt I had really accomplished a lot getting across the languages like French and Latin that I needed for my studies, the language and the dialect variation I needed to speak the language that I teach. And then I come to Milwaukee, and so now I've been learning Oneida and Ho-Chunk and Menominee. So I think we have to remember how multilingual this space would have been for thousands of years, really, to come to this part of the Great Lakes, really between Green Bay, Milwaukee, and Chicago. Those were cosmopolitan sites of trade and exchange and entertainment for many, many centuries. And I can just imagine what it must have been like, all the languages that would mix in that space.
So how similar are they, or how dissimilar are they? Was it easy for your ancestors 100, 200, 300 years ago to communicate with members of other nations, given the difference in languages?
Throughout the world, there are some major language family groups. So as English speakers, it's easy for us to learn other languages in that language family. So to learn French and Italian can feel a little bit similar. You find words that are in common. In the indigenous language group, that's how it feels between Ojibwe and, say, Menominee or Cree. They're in the same family. In Milwaukee, we have this incredible opportunity of having three language families mixing. So the Ho-Chunk is from the Siouan language family, and the Oneida is from the Iroquoian language family. So they are very, very dissimilar. There's really nothing, when you hear them, that you can latch on to. The grammar is different, everything about it. But that also means you have completely different worldviews. So people who come into this space bringing maybe their own language and learning one or more of these, they have entirely new ways of looking at the world.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio, Margaret Newden, who is the head of the Electa Quinney Institute, which is the home for Native American students on the UWM campus. And right alongside her, we have Nathan Bry, who himself is a student and from the Lac du Flambeau tribe or nation here in Wisconsin. Because this is radio, let's use this wonderful medium to share with our listeners the sound of some of the languages we've been discussing. Would you folks like to say a few words in the languages that you are most comfortable with?
Sure. I think the things that are easy that we sometimes share are the phrases that people can use. So, gamigwechwigo, we thank everyone, is a phrase that I often teach folks. Another really common one that almost every student asks to learn is gizagain, which is I love you. And a lot of times we have parents who...
Gizagain.
Yes.
Did I say that right?
Well said. Exactly. Yeah, okay. We have parents who want to take a language class and get an A, but they also want to be able to have something they can pass on to their kids or call back home and say to those aunts and uncles or some of the other family members who may not have had a chance to learn the language.
How about you, Nathan? What do you want to share with us today?
Well, as Margaret said earlier in the program, Minogijibaogut is a good morning. So that's a common phrase that you hear in indigenous communities. There's when you walk up to someone, or ani, or buju, which is another way of saying hello.
Do you speak any of the language with your family today?
Yes, I try to. As much as I can, I try to teach all my children. Some of them are more perceptive than others. My older ones are get embarrassed when I talk in front of their friends, you know, oh, dad, please, type of a thing.
Typical teenagers, right?
Typical teenager stuff, right. But it's surprisingly how much they actually pick up. Like when they want to speak to me in the language, it's amazing that they will say certain words to me in the language. So even though I'm embarrassing them, I still keep it up because I know that they're picking it up, and eventually they'll start talking in the language when they want to.
Do you ever talk at the dinner table in the language, or is it just off the cuff?
I talk all the time. Like, there's no rhyme or reason to when I talk in the language. Sometimes I'll just walk around the house speaking in the language. It gets me to practice the language, and it also gets them listening to it. So even though they may not understand what I'm saying, they're still hearing it. So eventually it'll sink in and help them put words together or help them make sense later on in life.
How does it make you feel when you're speaking in the language that your ancestors used?
Well, I hope I do... my family proud when I speak the language. I'm all about revitalizing the language and spreading the language to everyone. So hopefully, eventually, everyone will be speaking the Ojibwe language.
Uh-huh. Is it your sense that language is still alive today?
Oh, for sure, it's still alive. It's there's not that many speakers right now. The numbers are about roughly 6,000 fluent speakers, and about 4,000, maybe 5,000 of them are 60 or older. So we're losing our fluency. So my whole goal is that to bring back some of that fluency and help teach our children, and it helps us understand the culture and what our ancestors were thinking about, you know, 'cause it gives us an insight to what they did, right?
So besides remembering the language itself and not just memorializing it, but as you said, make it come alive, what else do you learn through Electa Quinney that allows you to feel better connected to your past?
Well, first off, the language is a key thing for me, right? So by better understanding the language, I can better understand things that my uncle taught me growing up and better understand some of the things that I read in history, because everything that you read in history is interpreted, most of the stuff that you read in history is interpreted. So by understanding what they're saying, what the language is, you can better understand what actually is being translated. Case in point, treaties. Most of the treaties were done in English, so when you read what our elders were saying about those treaties, you get a whole different perspective on what actually they thought going into the signing of the treaty.
And those treaties still have a big bearing on Native American life today, don't they?
For sure.
Margaret, as you hear Nathan describe his experiences and this yearning to connect to the past through the language, how do you as a teacher feel looking at someone who is carrying that mantle forward?
Nathan, Michigan, Quasens Jinkazo Abbey, Mina Abbey Kidot Nitta Knamaget Nathan. So I am really happy to see how well he teaches. And I was recently in Michigan where I met a student that Nathan had actually had in his class because he's gone on to teach first year Ojibwe. And she was telling me what a great teacher he was. So I think that as much as we might all recognize what we still have to learn, we need to celebrate the fact that we do have some capacity. I can walk away from the first year class. Even today, we've left someone in the first year class on campus who is a student who took the language for 3 years, and now she's teaching the first year class. So we really need to build that capacity and have people hear the language and practice it more.
Is your institute unique, or are there other campuses around the country, other communities around the country that are encouraging people to keep their culture, keep their languages alive as Native Americans?
Well, since the 1991 Native American Languages Act, when it became legal again for us to speak and publish our language in the United States, we have had more presence in higher education. Prior to that, it was not a common thing for someone to be able to take their language and have it count toward their degree credits. It would perhaps just be a culture credit. So we
really, what was the year for that?
1991.
Oh my gosh! Until then, you really were not encouraged or allowed to.
It was illegal in the United States because if you look back into the history, as Nathan was mentioning, when you read the Declaration of Independence very carefully, you find a certain stance toward Native people. When you read citizenship and treaty regulations and in congressional acts, you'll find a history there that really worked to suppress the use of Native languages because that was the enemy state. As the United States was growing and building itself as a nation, these were perceived as other nations that could be threatening. And so until 1991, it was not recognized that they should have a right to speak and publish in their own languages. So now my task is really to do equal scholarship. And I think from our provost down to my colleagues in my own home Department of English, which is ironically where my tenure is, I've had nothing but a wonderful experience here where people treat this as a modern language that can enrich their own research in a lot of ways.
I was surprised when I was, again, researching for this program that not only are you considered American citizens as Native Americans, but you're also considered international students at the university. Dual citizenship. Explain that.
You have nations and confederacies that existed, and when the United States began forming itself as a nation, there were many occasions when that was recognized. So what you have in all of the 560 nations across the United States are federal entities with their own constitutions and citizenship and taxation and their own economic and educational issues that they are continuing to address just the way any other nation is. So there are agreements between nations. It's not a matter of a group of students who are coming to me in my office saying, how do I assimilate and become an American citizen? But really, it's almost the reverse. How do I maintain my identity as an ambassador of another nation present here in the United States? So it's an interesting problem to work through because not only are the students sometimes unprepared to articulate that, the people around them are also kind of unaware of that history sometimes.
And so, Nathan, for you, the involvement in the Institute, the Electa Quinney Institute, is a vehicle for you to both maintain your connection to the past and also begin to build new relationships with people from other nations.
Correct. I'm hoping that I can make a path for other students so they don't have to fight as hard to get their voices heard on campus or in their own community. Because there's a lot of the indigenous voice is not something that is heard very often. And most people like yourself did not even know how many tribes were located in Wisconsin. So people that even teach history, even history about Wisconsin, don't even know how many tribes are located in Wisconsin or how they came to be in Wisconsin.
How do you feel today about your American citizenship? The fact that you are, part of the United States, and yet you were here long before the United States. Your people were here long before the United States ever was formed or organized.
I try to do the best I can for the most people, for not just my people, but for everyone involved. So, like at the Electoquinny office, we invite everyone into the office that wants to learn, that wants to participate in this knowledge. So I try to spread my wings and let everyone help come in and guide them in the right way.
It sounds like Nathan's a good role model, Margaret.
He definitely is. I know that there are younger students. He was a McNair scholar. He is now an AOP scholar, and he's in graduate school. And he definitely, I think, is a role model for a number of young students on campus. So we're happy to have him in the mix in our community.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I want to let our listeners know that we're not done yet, even though this program is going to be over in just a couple of minutes. We've decided that we're going to do a second program that you'll hear next week right here on WUWM, where we're going to listen to some of the music of the nations here in the state. Tell us what we're going to be bringing into the studio, physically into the studio, Margaret.
We thought it would be fun to share the history of a big drum that we have on campus. People may have seen drums like this at powwows or other public gatherings. And there are recordings of this drum from the 1970s. It would be wonderful to have new recordings of this drum and the people who sing on it today, because it was made by the elders in the 1970s who wanted to have presence on campus and connect the work of schools in Milwaukee to our campus and sing while doing that. And so it's wonderful to see when the students on campus pull the drum out and sing. And so we thought that would be fun to share.
And Nathan, you're going to be joining us for the program next week.
For sure. I'm the drum keeper of that big drum right now. So,
Margaret Newden, who leads the Electoquinny Institute at UWM, joined by Nathan Bry, a student who will both be back on next week's program as we listen to the music of our Native American ancestors. Thank you so much. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.